Find all sorts of opinions and add your own. abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome. Cassie McCullough with you on Life Matters this morning. Now, a star of Instagram is coming our way. Australia's Sarah Jane Adams has followers around the world who are obsessed with her rather wild style, her crazy outfits, her messy shock of white hair, and her who-gives-a-damn attitude have made her a real fashion guru among the 15 to 35-year-old set, which is quite interesting considering she's just entering her seventh decade. We'll meet Sarah Jane and get a dose of her devil-may-care rock and roll attitude a little later on. Also this morning, organised crime in Australia. The Calabrian branch of the Italian Mafia is considered to be the most powerful, the most dangerous and the wealthiest of all. And they're alive and well and operating in almost every state and territory in Australia, according to one of our guests this morning. Former Assistant Commissioner of the New South Wales Police, Clive Small, has co-written a book about the 'Ndrangheta and its entrenched presence here. He says they're hiding in plain sight. So the history, the dirty, dirty history of the Calabrian Mafia in our midst ahead of us on Life Matters. In a moment, we're going to talk education and teacher attrition rates. They're quite startling figures that have come to light. I think you'll be surprised by how many young teachers are bailing out of the system. But just before we do, yesterday on Life Matters, we were talking about invisible women, how society chooses to ignore the sex workers in our midst and also murdered sex workers, the authors of this new book were in. One of the points they made was that sex workers have often been stereotyped, but they operate in all kinds of different areas of society, and it's some surprising ones as well. Here's a call from Cecily from Victoria, who rang in yesterday.
I've worked in the TAFE and university sector, and I can tell you that a lot of students, female students and males, resort to being sex workers because they find it's the easiest way for them to make money. In our current education system, they're not supported by us and therefore they're resorting to this dangerous practice.
Interesting to hear that. I was quite surprised by those comments from Stephanie saying that in her experience, this isn't uncommon at all. If you want to give us your thoughts on any of these topics, do go to our listener line and let us know what you think. We're always keen to get your comments. That's 02833. Oh, well, I think I've forgotten the rest of it. I haven't got it off the top of my head right now. Oh, yeah, 1430. Thank you very much. 02833 1430 is the listener line if you ever want to leave us a comment. Well, we've been hearing this morning about education funding. Yesterday, opposition leader Bill Shorten committed Labor to multi-billion dollar reforms. It's clear that education is going to be a major battleground in this year's federal election. But money aside, another issue is looming in the sector, and that's teacher attrition rates. Right now, a fresh batch of new teachers are starting their first year. After four or so years at university, they're now standing in front of 20 to 25 plus kids in a classroom. But within 5 years, 30 to 50% of those first year teachers will no longer be teaching. For every 10 teachers walking into a classroom for the first time, right about now maybe, or even on Monday, 3 to 5 of them will leave the profession and be doing something else. That's a lot of wasted time and a lot of wasted money for everyone involved. So why do they leave? Professor Stephen Dinham is the Chair of Teacher Education at the University of Melbourne. G'day, Stephen. Welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Kathy.
These are massive numbers dropping out of our education system. Straight off the bat, Stephen, can I ask you whether it's possible that's just a lot of people that simply aren't suited to teaching? Is this just the sorting of the chaff from the wheat?
I think it's a bit more complex than that. We need to look at who actually makes up this group. They're older than they used to be. They're, in the case of primary teaching, about 85% are women. Case of secondary teaching, about 60% of women. And it's not simply a matter that those who leave are not cut out for the job. People have other reasons for leaving. And in fact, I'd done some work on teacher satisfaction and resignation for quite a number of years. And often, it's people who actually are leaving not because they can't do the job, but they're dissatisfied for various things outside what the core business is. And they also see themselves having more opportunity somewhere else because the skills of teachers are quite transferable. So I think it's a very broad brush to simply say they're leaving because they're not up to standard. There's a whole range of other reasons.
So perhaps teaching for many people is a kind of gateway or a stepping stone to another profession because, as you say, they're translatable skills. What about the challenges that teachers face in those first years? Obviously, you're saying they're older, so their experience of the classroom is now a little bit further behind them. But it's a tough place to stand in front of a whole bunch of kids and maintain control as well as hopefully provide some kind of enrichment.
Look, it's a very challenging profession. It always has been. One of the key things is variability. There's variability in terms of teacher education courses, but there's also variability in terms of when people get into schools. And some people walk into a situation which is supportive. They're recognised as being a novice, but they're also recognised as having recent training. You know, they're supported, they're challenged, people work with them. In other cases, people are left to their own devices. And unfortunately, we had this thing in teaching where we send our raw recruits to the most difficult schools in some cases. And it's a sort of baptism by fire or survival of the fittest. I think we need to do a lot more around bridging the gap between university training and schools and in providing ongoing support for people because they're novices. I mean, they're not experts. And the Australian standards for teachers that we've got recognise the fact that people take a number of years to reach a standard of proficiency. So I think in many cases our expectations are very, very high for them. In many cases, they're given difficult classes, they're in challenging circumstances. We can't prepare people for every sort of context they're going to find themselves in. And that's why we need to think about teacher education, if you like, as being an ongoing thing, not something that ends when they finish their university course.
Yes, that no doubt is true. But it is said often that a practical classroom experience, that there isn't enough of it in the degree. How do universities try to address that?
It's quality and quantity of in-school experience. Obviously, we want to give people as much experience in schools as we possibly can, but it needs to be a situation where the university and the schools are working very, very closely together as we try and do at Melbourne so that everybody's on the same page and basically there's a strong evidence base to what you do. Unfortunately, there are some beginning teachers who get told, you know, this is how we do it here, forget everything you've learned at university and then, you know, we tried this in 1975 and it didn't work. On the other hand, some people are walking into a situation which is extremely supportive, professional, and they really get challenged, they really get supported to develop in their professional practice. So again, this variability is a big issue. But I think we're pretty unrealistic about what we're expecting people to do. You know, I've heard some senior education people say on different occasions that teaching's never been more challenging. Well, you can argue about that, but because of that fact, we don't have time to help people, which is a very strange paradox.
Yeah, and I guess that the idea of mentoring looks good on paper, but as you say, the variability is quite extreme and it's only the people that you're dealing with, you know, it's whether you get someone who knows what they're doing, knows how to encourage you, knows how to get the best out of someone. But tell us about behaviour management in the classroom because this comes up time and again as one of the biggest problems for teachers. And you say it's always been a tough job, but have kids fundamentally changed?
Oh, I think there's been some changes. I think society itself in some ways has become more permissive. I mean, if you go back a few decades, and I've been in the game for a while, the default position was normally that parents would support the school and the teachers in what they were trying to do. In many cases now, the default position is to oppose the teachers and oppose the school and to protect the student. So I think we're paying a bit of a price for that, the fact that society itself is more challenging, more permissive and so on. Kids are certainly more likely to present challenging behaviours and so on. The thing about behaviour management, it comes with experience and expertise, and it's not something you learn in isolation. And one of the things I say to beginning teachers is one of the best classroom management strategies you're ever going to get is a well-prepared lesson. Whereas beginning teachers often, they're searching for the tricks or the strategies that enable them to get control of the class so that they can then teach them. It's a two-way thing. Classroom management is very much bound up in having good lessons, well-planned lessons geared to the needs of the students, where they're at and so forth. It's not a matter of learning some tricks to control the class, and I think often we fall into that trap.
Mm. On Life Matters, we're talking with Professor Stephen Dinham. He's the Chair of Teacher Education about the from the University of Melbourne, about this rate of attrition among young teachers. Between 30 and 50% of them are out of the profession after their first 5 years. That's a really stunning amount, considering that we have a teacher shortage looming in the future and the age of teachers is increasing as well. I understand that many teachers are 50 and above.
Yeah, we have an ageing profession, although that's been coming around a little bit in the last little while. Look, but the rates have been fairly high, but it's hard to get good figures for some time. But again, it's very variable, and you've got to take into account the feminisation of the teaching profession as well. I mean, many people will take time out. They will be seen as a resignation because they've taken time out for child rearing and so on. And as I said, 85% of primary teachers are female, and it's well over 50% now in secondary education. So it's not as if they're lost forever. There's an awful lot of people out there who are trained teachers who could come back and may well come back after a period of time out. So I think we need to be, you know, quite flexible in terms of our employment arrangements, because one of the things that sometimes happens is that when people have time out for child rearing, for example, they lose seniority and then come back and find themselves on the bottom of the pile again. But the resignation thing is quite interesting, because there's a hidden resignation peak that I picked up 10 or 15 years ago, and it's when people get to the top of the salary scales. Now, the way salary scales are operating for teachers, it's lockstep annual progression pretty much. And most people get to the top of the salary scale after about 8 to 10 years experience. So there's another resignation peak there, which is of concern. And these are people who basically got to the top of the salary scale, looked around and said, well, okay, yeah, here I am. Do I stay here forever, or do I seek promotion out of the classroom, or do I do something else? And in fact, when we've researched this, what we've found is that the people who leave are not so much dissatisfied. They're people who are actually seeking other opportunities, because they see in other professions people's salaries taking off, whereas in teaching they're stalling after 8 to 10 years.
Mm. But there isn't, as we keep being told, endless money in the bucket to provide exponential salary raises for teachers.
No, and beginning salaries for teachers are quite reasonable. It's what happens after that's the problem. Mm. Now, we've now got 4 levels of teaching standards in Australia, including 3 in schools, and that provides an opportunity for people to be recognised and rewarded for their ongoing professional learning, to have access to some higher salary scales, because basically we have a very flat structure, and teachers at the top of the salary scale only earn about 1.5 times or less what a beginning teacher earns. Whereas in other careers, the salary structures are such that the most able people can be recognised, rewarded for that. So we have a 19th century salary career structure, which doesn't help the process.
Mm.
But the one thing I'd say about teacher resignation from the research we've been doing, we've done it about 8 countries over quite a number of years. When we talk to people who've resigned from teaching, they tell us a number of things. They rate the core business of teaching very highly, even when they resign. Working with kids, seeing them achieve, changing their behaviour for the better, you know, the wonder of people being able to learn, you know, when you get through, and the spark of learning, all that sort of stuff, people rate very, very highly. They tend to rate very lowly the societal stuff that's out there, the perceptions that teachers have an easy life, long holidays, short hours, glorified childminding, etc., not a real job. The other thing that comes up as being quite important, though, in the middle is satisfaction with school-based factors, and this is where we get variability. And people who resign are often resigning not because they don't enjoy the core business, and in many cases not because of the societal stuff they can't control. It's things like the leadership, the culture, the environment in the school, and that's where we'd have to do a lot more work, because you can get 2 schools that are very similar on the surface, and a teacher will flourish in one school and they will fail in another school, and it's not down to them, it's down to that environment.
on Life Learners. We're talking teacher attrition rates. Perhaps you're a former teacher listening right now, and this is really resonating for you. Why did you leave? Are some of these reasons among them? The number is the listener line is 0283 1430 or 1300 225 576, 1300 225 576. Stephen, you're saying that maintaining the great teachers is one of the difficulties, simply because the pay may not be there. Does this cause a sort of problem, a systemic problem, with the private and public sectors competing to get teachers, and the private sector being able to offer a little bit more and sometimes a lot more than the public sector?
Oh, there's not much doubt, and there is a general perception that the non-government sector is an easier sector to work in, which is not always true. But what tends to happen is often the hiring systems in public education in the various states and territories can be a bit bureaucratic and cumbersome. And often people get dissatisfied with that and they get snapped up by a non-government school. So to some degree, the non-government schools are cherry-picking. But it also happens within the government system as well. People tend to favour the higher SES, socioeconomic status, government schools over the low SES schools. So we tend to have this churn that happens where beginning teachers go to a school that's seen as difficult, demonstrate some success there, those who stay, and then they move on to something better. I mean, that's the way it's been for a long, long time. It's worse in the country. It's worse when you're trying to get leaders to go into some of the country and regional schools and the low SES schools. So there's a real big issue around workforce planning and making sure that we have a good mixture of teachers across the landscape rather than having all our beginning teachers in one sort of school.
Let's hear from Hannah, who's given us a call. G'day, Hannah.
Oh, yes. Very quick.
Now, you're saying you're saying that successional academics are the forgotten teachers. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so anyone who has been in academia knows that there are the contracts, people on contract, people who are permanent, and tenure doesn't probably exist anymore. And there are the overwhelming majority who are the sessional academics, of which I have been one for 25 years, and we have absolutely no rights whatsoever. So I always look on the teachers, and I am also Victorian Institute of Teaching, so I can get a job in a school, but I haven't been able to. I look on them with envy because they get holidays and all the usual things, but we get absolutely nothing.
Mm. All right, thanks for that, Hannah. Your thoughts, Stephen?
Oh, it's been a growing issue with the financial pressures on universities to utilise more sessional staff. And yes, they don't have the rights that tenured staff have got. They're also, in many cases, not fully employed, so they're doing a number of different jobs. But also they don't get a chance to become integrated into the life of, say, a faculty of education or whatever. On the other hand, there's a very positive aspect to this because we utilise a lot of people who are actually in schools as sessional lecturers to teach in specialist areas like some of the secondary teaching subjects. So the benefit in that is that we've got people with current experience in schools who are working with our candidates. So it cuts both ways. But I certainly feel for the sessionals because it's become much worse over recent years, I think.
Yeah, indeed, and I'm sure it has. Thanks very much for that, Hannah. I can't help picturing these young teachers in classrooms with all these challenges, and we haven't even talked about the complexity of the modern classroom, children with issues at home or behaviour or emotional problems, physical disabilities, which can add to the workload, and also English as a second language. I mean, that is a very complicated task that we give people who walk into our classrooms every day. And I can see why throwing up your hands may actually be sometimes a sane option.
Yeah, I think it's very variable. For some people, that is the best thing. I mean, until you've actually done it full time, you probably don't know what it's really like, despite all the efforts we might make to give you an idea of it. And some people will decide it's not for them, but also some people will find themselves in those very challenging circumstances where they haven't got the support they need. But it does come back to teacher training, initial training, and you know, we've had a succession of investigations and inquiries into teacher education, including the most recent 2014 report that Christopher Pine initiated. And there's a strong message coming out in that report that what we do in teacher education has to be very strongly based. It has to be based upon what we know works. There has to be good relationships with schools. People have to be on the same page in terms of what we're trying to achieve. We have to pay attention to the quality of people who come into teaching. We have to pay attention to the quality and impact of teacher education courses. The thing is, people often look for, you know, silver bullets or quick fixes, and if we're going to address teacher quality and through that teacher retention, we've got to look at every key point of leverage where we've got some control. For example, the quality of people who come in, the quality of the programs, the quality of the in-school experience, the quality of the support once they begin teaching. There's no single solution to this, like, oh, let's just raise ATARs. It's a very simplistic solution. It's much more complex.
It's a conversation that many people have been having over many years and will continue to do so. Thank you very much for talking with us this morning, Stephen.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
That's Professor Stephen Dinham. He's the Chair of Teacher Education at the University of Melbourne. We'd love to hear what you think, especially if you're a teacher or a former teacher. How are you coping with, you know, the life in and out of the classroom? Give us a call if you like, or leave a comment on our website or Facebook page. It's very easy to find. In a moment, we're getting some of the background, the history of the Calabrian Mafia in Australia.
In the body sphere, people who make a living bending over backwards. Contortionists, like the amazing Christina, who's 71 years old and still performing.
As a professional contortionist, I am the oldest and probably the oldest that there ever has been. And who knows, maybe the oldest there ever will be, because I haven't got any plans to retire anytime soon.
Great feats of flexibility in the body sphere this afternoon at 1 on RM.
On Life Matters, I'm Cassie McCullough, and you may or may not have been a fan of Tony Soprano or even the Godfather television series. That's generally how we think of the Mafia, but in present-day Australia, not too many of us would consider it a reality in our lives and as a threat to the society that we live in. Clive Small is a former Assistant Commissioner of the New South Wales Police, and he'd beg to differ. He's the guy you might remember who headed up the investigation into the backpacker murders in the Belangolo State Forest. And he says that the Calabria Mafia is alive and well, thriving in fact, but in plain sight. Welcome to Life Matters, Clive.
Thank you, Cassie.
Now, the tentacles of this branch of the Mafia, the Calabrian Mafia, the 'Ndrangheta, Do they still operate on a global scale? Is the Australian arm of it connected to still roots in Italy?
The Calabrian-based mafia, that is the one that is still in Italy, where its headquarters are, where the parent body is, where the mother company is, if you like, is today more powerful and stronger and more financially well off than it's ever been. And it's had a very significant resurgence in the last 10, 15 or so years.
And Australia,
the Australian-based elements of the Calabrian Mafia have benefited from that.
So you're comparing them to the Sicilian Mafia and the one in Naples as well, the Neapolitan Mafia?
No, I'm not... There really are three mafias. There is the Sicilian Mafia, the one that we've traditionally seen on television and all of that, which comes from, if you like, the northern end of Italy. In the middle, generally, we have the Camorra, which is a separate and distinct mafia, but which is probably the smallest of the three. And then at the bottom, in the southern tip, in the foot of Italy, we have the Calabrian Mafia, the 'Ndrangheta, which today is the biggest and wealthiest of the three.
Right. Now, I just want to be quite clear here, because it's difficult to talk about the Mafia, the Calabrian Mafia, as Calabrians. I mean, I'm thinking of a friend of mine who is from Calabria, and almost every time she's introduced to someone new, all the, you know, the jokes, the associations
yes.
come up. We are not talking about that entire section of the Australian community. It's just a small part of it.
The Calabrian Mafia has one very fundamental difference to the other two. and that is it is very strongly based on family connections. And it's, the families are historic. In Calabria, they still actually dominate the towns, they dominate the areas, they have significant political and other pull. And really, these are parts where traditionally there hasn't been a lot of genuine law enforcement action within Italy. Things have changed now, but there's still a big battle. In Australia, what happened, we had a substantial migration from Italy beginning in the early 1900s, and Calabrians were a significant part of that migration system. As best we know now, in 1922, the first of the known Calabrian mafia godfathers arrived in Sydney, or arrived in Australia. And within a couple of years, they'd established themselves very significantly in the cane fields in Queensland through violence, and I'm happy to expand on that a bit. By the late 20s, we'd had them established in Sydney and actively seeking out their position, and also we had them established in Melbourne. Now, Melbourne had their first Calabrian murder in 1925 when a constable was stabbed to death. Sydney had their first known Calabrian murders about 1930, maybe a bit earlier, when a whole stack of Calabrian documents relating to arrangements for the syndicate, the ritual for swearing someone in as a made person, were all found here in Sydney, and where one person in a letter to his father back in Calabria says, "I'm not going back to Italy, I'll be arrested and jailed, I'm staying in Sydney and we will lead the evil life,"
mm-hmm.
which is what the Calabrian Mafia has as one of its names.
And this is part of the mythology that is so intriguing about this group, the way they've kind of turned the idea of this evil life, or the Honourable Society is another name that they choose to call themselves. This must be pretty, well, attractive for a young man, teenager coming up through the family and being initiated into this strange world.
Absolutely. The Sicilian Mafia is certainly a lot older than the Calabrian Mafia, but the Calabrian Mafia have written this rather romantic story about how they were formed and about knights coming to save the people and this noble cause group formed and all that. The fact of the matter is it was formed by a group of criminals in a town at the turn of the century, which was very poverty-stricken and not much educational training. But I think what really shows the difference is and why the Calabrian Mafia has been so hard to tackle is the fact that the family connections are so strong. And the example of that is there have been, in terms of the Sicilian Mafia, there's been over the years about 1,000 Mafia figures who've rolled over. Who's given up the Sicilian Mafia.
Mates.
And I'm talking about back in Calabria.
Mm-hmm.
In the Camorra, there's been about 2,000 people rolled over. Interestingly, in the Calabrian Mafia, there's been about 400.
Right.
Now, that shows how they stick together. And a lot of that is based, you get a good idea of how they stick together from a couple of conversations that have been heard, one between two young people, teenagers, whose fathers were mafia bosses. And they're talking about the mafia, what they're going to have to do when they grow up. They might even be killed because of their family connections, but they talk about fear and respect. Without any fear, there is no respect.
Mm.
You have to instill fear.
These are Australian based?
One Australian, one Calabrian,
mm.
talking to relatives overseas.
So fear is the modus operandi. Absolutely.
There is no statute of limitations on retaliation for people who offend the mafia, who breach its code or who betray it in what they would call a betrayal in some way. That may be simply a double-crossing in a drug deal.
Mm-hmm.
It could be anything. But I think one of the most probably infamous and reported instances of it was, and it's been reported back in the 30s, 1930s, with all the migration to Australia, a Calabrian figure who offended the daughter of a major mafia figure, Calabrian mafia figure in Calabria, he sent two people out here to Australia to find the person. He was murdered. It's reported that his heart was cut out and was taken back to Italy to show the father that the penalty had been carried.
It's so brutal. It really is. You also outline a case in your book about a bloke in Queensland having his ears cut off as a
cop. Well, that's another one. He was a person who had allegedly made comments. The ears were cut off as a of symbolism. But when he never gave the mafia up, and the police were... The mafia actually went and congratulated him on being an honourable fellow.
The bloke who cut his ears off visited him in hospital.
Hospital, exactly. It shows you how this betrayal and payback and the relations that existed. But they're very complicated relations. And I think what says it all, that today there are 31 families, 31 Calabrian families spread across Australia, except for the Northern Territory, who report to 9 families of Calabrian bosses based in Calabria.
What are they doing? What's their...
They're doing business.
Yeah, and so what activities? So
I should say is that when I say 9 families in Calabria, the 9 families are correct, but what you find is that there's a lot of intermarriage between the 9 families. And when you actually look at it, it comes down to really about 4 or 5 families, and they are significant figures and bosses over there. The way it still works, it's somewhat like a federation. The Sicilian mafia is like a hierarchical structure. So you take a boss out and that has a major dramatic effect all the way down the line. What you have with the Calabrians is that the Calabrian bosses approve the establishment of a cell in another country. So let's just talking about Australia, approve the establishment of a cell of the group in Australia. They approve the boss of that cell. The bosses that they've approved are in these families that report back to them. And they operate like a federation.
It sounds like a corporate structure, actually.
It is. But
it
what
sounds
it means,
very modern and very practiced, a well-oiled machine.
Well-oiled. And what it also means, though, is if a boss is taken out, it only has a local impact.
Mm.
It might be big, but it will be temporary and local.
So very stable.
So what they are doing is returning money, payments to their parent body back in Calabria, and... In general, it might be the parent body is also helping them with, say, the supply of drugs. They have a financial arrangement between them. They act in a way that approves and doesn't disregard the families.
We're talking on Life Matters on Radio National with Clive Small. He and the journalist Tom Gilling have written a book about the Calabrian Mafia in Australia. It's called Evil Life, and it tracks the history and also the current activities of the Calabrian Mafia. So we are talking drugs. I mean, a couple of years ago, I think Australia had the world's biggest ecstasy bust.
Yes.
Tins and tins of tomatoes actually filled with little white pills. There was footage of just a warehouse full of this stuff. What else are they doing?
Well, it's mainly drugs. I mean, what I think is most interesting and requires some explanation is that in 1995, the National Crime Authority issued a report saying there was no mafia, no Italian-style Calabrian mafia in Australia. There is ample evidence that was not made public at the time to dispute that. But at that time, a few years before that statement, an inquiry was conducted and found that of 250 people arrested on cannabis crops in the years before, something like 60% of those people were tied to 15 families by blood.
Mm-hmm.
And a much larger number were tied indirectly. And it was estimated that the Calabrian Mafia, who had been identified as such by the Woodward Royal Commission in the 70s, were responsible for an estimated something like 90% of cannabis growth cultivation in Australia. After that, it was said there was no mafia in Australia.
So what are you getting to there? You're saying that really there's a blind eye being turned to it, or is it something more sinister than that?
No, it certainly raises a lot of questions as to the basis of that claim. Now, what happened for the next 16 years, there was a denial of existence of the mafia in Australia, or there was absolute silence about it. In 2011, we get a statement from the Australian Crime Commission, which is the was a name change from the National Crime Authority.
Yep.
A simple one-liner saying, oh, there is a Calabrian mafia, the Andrangheta has a footprint in Australia. Just before that statement is made, Mick Kelty, the former head of the Australian Federal Police, says publicly that the international Calabrian mafia is responsible for more than 60% of the drugs imported to Southeast Australia. That shows a dramatic change during the 16 years of denial. They've gone from being cannabis cultivators to arguably the largest importation group of drugs into Australia.
So the Wood Royal Commission report, Woodward, thank you. The recommendations or the findings were ignored, and the Calabrian Mafia was allowed to flourish in this country.
What happened, the Woodward Royal Commission ran from 1977 to 1980, and he brought down a very significant report with recommendations. There was a lot of activity in the few years that followed, but then for some reason, the activity died off and we're in a state of denial. That has never been explained. But the period of denial has allowed the Andrangheta in Australia to flourish, and that requires explanation.
In researching this book, Clive Small, with Tom Gilling, did you have access to material that hadn't been seen before, and how willing were people to give you access to stuff?
Over the years, I've had quite a deal of assistance and support. A lot of people are very frustrated, but quite obviously I can't discuss my sources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you say the influence of this these families extends where? How far? How far up?
What happened starting in the night up till about the 1970s, the Andrangheta in Australia was very traditional. That is, it looked at issues like extortion from its own people, protection money, control of market gardens and all of that sort of thing. But it focused very much on its own people with just some minor spin-offs. Also, significant corruption and alliance with political parties and stuff like that to ensure their own support. And also corruption generally in law enforcement and a number of other areas. After Bob Trimboli introduced the Calabrian Mafia to the cannabis cultivation
in the Riverina district,
it spread rapidly. And basically, when he introduced it, he came like a used car salesman. Have I got a deal for you?
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you guys know how to cultivate crops. I've got a new crop for you, cannabis, and you'll get a lot more money out of it. I, on the other hand, can supply the networks that will sell it and buy it. So that meant that for the first time they were like dealing with outsiders.
Outsourcing the distribution.
Outsourcing. And that meant from that point on they started then doing deals with, if you like, non-Calabrian crime figures. That's best seen, if you like, in the world's biggest ecstasy bust that you just mentioned, where there are 31 people arrested. Of those arrested, a number of them were Calabrian mafia figures, but a number of others were notorious criminals, well-established, and who knew the penalty if they'd betrayed them. So that showed a sort of a multicultural network, but centred very much with the Calabrian mafia figures organising the supply of the drugs.
So here we come back to the fear and respect idea. It must be very hard for people to leave if they want to, almost impossible.
Absolutely, because what we don't understand in Australia, we've been very lucky in many ways, but what we don't understand in Australia is a number of these Calabrian people who, if they still have families back in Calabria. So if you betray the Calabrian mafia here or disrespect them, your family at risk in Calabria, your family in Calabria is at risk or may be at risk. In addition, your family in Australia may be at risk. But I'm just saying there are a number of options.
How do you feel about having done this work?
Well, I think it's...
Do you feel, you know, like you're happy walking the streets? You don't feel in any way that you've brought attention to people who don't want it?
Well, I think we've certainly brought attention to people that don't want it. I think what remains to be seen is how this matter is followed up, what the governments have to say about it, what law enforcement and other bodies have to say about it, what immigration has to say about it. Because immigration, going back to the 1930s and 60s, played an enormous part in the expansion of this body in Australia. But really, it's no point ignoring the problem. The Federal Police investigation of the World Biggest Ecstasy Bus was a very good, very positive, very aggressive operation, very successful. But it was a setback. It wasn't a destruction of the group. It was a temporary
setback.
A pretty big setback.
There was
but
a lot of pallets of those temporary ones.
A temporary one.
Yeah.
You can't take your foot off the accelerator now because you've had one success. What we need is the accelerator needs to be pressed even further, and other bodies, state and federal, need to get together and do something about this problem because the political influence even is quite significant.
Well, I wonder who will have, I guess, the guts to do that, where that will come from.
Well, I think the biggest challenge for both parties, and I'm not here to pick one party or the other, but both parties, is to say publicly, we are going to do something about it and you can hold us to account. The risk they have in doing that is that they might bring to the fore and highlight issues in the past that they're not so...
from their own
willing
history.
To have made public.
Yeah, and there are names.
But they've got to stand up
right
if we're going to move forward.
Yeah, names right through the history of, and through your book, they're very familiar to all of us. Clive, thank you very much for explaining just a little bit of this extraordinary and very hidden culture and organised crime group.
Thank you very much, Cass.
That's Clive Small. He's the former Assistant Commissioner of the New South Wales Police. And along with the journalist Tom Gilling, he's written a book called Evil Life about the Calabrian Mafia's presence in Australia. And, well, they're rattling a cage. Let's see what the results of that are. Coming up next, we're going to meet a woman who's an accidental Instagram star.
What's summer like for you?
Dry and dusty?
Or sweaty and humid?
I'm Tim Edwistle.
And I'm Matthew Crawford.
And on In Season, we look at Australia's changing summers.
And what you might experience outside.
Summer in Broome is the wet season. It means that we have many, many more shorebirds than we do during the winter period.
Shorebirds, bushfire.
And more.
On our occasional pop-up series.
In Season, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning here on RN.
Well, the woman we're about to meet is indeed a very special girl. I wouldn't go so far as to say a super freak, but she certainly has an extraordinary sense of style and taste. Hello, Sarah Jane.
Hello, Cassie. How are you today?
Well, thanks. Now, Sarah Jane Adams is your, your real name, but on Instagram... Mm-hmm. You're someone else.
On Instagram, my Instagram tag is, or handle is what it's called, is Saramai Jewels, which is S-A-R-A-M-A-I, Jewels. I've spent a lot of time in India, and my Indian family are my family, and apart from my husband and my children, obviously, but they called me Saramai. They named me Saramai some years ago. It's basically an extension of Sarah with a respectful ending for an elder person. So that's the Saramai, and I'm actually what I've been all my life is an antique jewellery dealer and a designer of antique style jewellery. So my Instagram handle reflects the fact that my life on Instagram started with my jewellery business, mm-hmm. working with my jewellery business. So that's why it's a bit of a weird...
Yes. Well, let me let the listeners know that you're sitting here with an extraordinary leopard print sports top.
It's Jeremy Scott for Adidas.
You've got your wonderful shock of white hair all kind of teased out. You're a hit on Instagram with a crowd that's probably, 15 to 30, 35, 40?
Exactly, yes.
Which is a bit of a surprise.
With a very, very... I have a really broad base of followers, which I think, I know that they come from all different parts of the world. I would say probably 70 or 80% female, but yes, a lot of young people who I think are interested to see that you can, in fact, have a free-spirited life still in the modern world, even though mine started 60 years ago.
yes, we have to say you're in your seventh decade.
Yes, I'm 61 in a few weeks' time. Yeah, so, but that's the body. That's not my spirit. I don't know whether my spirit's been here gazillions of times before, but the body is, yes, yeah. 61 years old.
Yeah, I know soon. What you mean. I think I'm about 19 on the inside.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, tell us how this happened to you, because this was a kind of accident.
Totally
one
by
of
accident.
Your children posted a picture of you on Instagram.
Yes, basically the way it started, Cassie, is that because I don't believe in spending money on advertising and promoting, because in my business I think, well, first of all, I'm a wholesale person and I can't put my jewellery up on the Instagram. I started with jewellery, and then one day I came downstairs and I was wearing a red Adidas vintage style jacket, and a couple of people made smart ass comments
in your family.
In my family. Well, one was my husband, and I'm used to him, but the other one was one of my daughter's boyfriends, and I just thought, you know what, this is really rude. And I was not angry, I was just a bit pissed off.
Cheesed off,
yes. So I said to my husband, come out here and take a photograph. And I leant against the wall in the backyard with a slight scalp, you know, folding my arms,
let's
bit
say
attitude.
Seething without a shirt.
Yeah. And he took a picture and we posted it, and I wrote some little comment, I've been told I look like something out of The Wizard of Oz and something like something out of Greece, and it's only 10 o'clock in the morning. Posted the photograph, went off to do the shopping, and my phone started pinging and ringing, and I said to my husband, can you sort this out, because my phone's binging and pinging. Anyway, I got home at about 7 o'clock at night. One of my kids rang me up and said, what do you think of what I've done, Mum? And I said, what have you done? And she said, oh, I've re-tagged your photograph, My Mum is Cooler Than Me, and Advanced Style. And I hadn't heard of even re-tag. I didn't know what hashtags were pretty much in those days. And she said, and Ari Seth Cohen wants to see you. And I said, who's Ari Seth Cohen? And she said, oh, he's a blogger from America who's got a film called Advanced Style coming out. And it seems that he's in Australia and he wants to take your photograph. I said, don't be silly. No, why would anyone want to do that? She said, no, Mum, go and check your emails. Have a look, because we have access to one another's emails through business. So I did indeed. And Ari contacted me. He was here promoting his film, Advanced Style, the first film. He was leaving the next day. He came over. He reshot the picture, put it up on his blog, and that's how it started.
That's where it all began. Mm. Ari Seth Cohen is an absolute style and tastemaker in New York. He's documented these extraordinary women from that city. I'm just laughing because I'm picturing one of them who has these giant round glasses. That's her.
That's Iris Apfel you're thinking of.
Yeah. And he's almost fetishized this kind of advanced style. He's made it into, an obsession for many people.
I don't know. I guess, yes, you're right. I suppose he has. I think he's made it, he's given older people permission to dress as wild and as wacky as they want. A lot of it just is how they dress. I mean, I've met most of those people because I've been in the States a few times, and Ari is now a dear, dear friend. And so, yes, he's kind of brought it all out of the closet, so to speak, and given people permission to really be creative and be themselves. And I think that a lot of older people perhaps have maybe felt a little bit uncomfortable. And of course, these women are, they are like this. You know, this is not pretending as I am. I just wear these clothes. This is just the way I am. So it's not difficult. It's not like it's a process that we're all going through to try and change and be a different personality. So, yes, but I think, Ari is definitely the main man. He's the one who started this whole awareness, most definitely.
So, really, your style is something that you've developed over years.
My style, you've talked about
being in different countries. I know that you're a big fan of Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones. Well, what is he?
God bless him.
He's a playboy.
What is he? Who knows? You'd have to ask Keith Richards.
Yeah. But so you each time you're taken by a whim, you take a photograph of what you're wearing, and really, how would you describe?
Oh, I just mix it up. I just mash up styles. I wear clothes that I still have clothes that I had when I was 18, 17. I have photographs of myself on my Instagram page on Sarah My Jewels that show, you know, the passport photograph from 1972, along with me wearing the same raggedy taggedy jacket now. So my style has always been this. And basically, when I was young, during the hippie times, at the end of the hippie times, I'm just that little bit young to be a true, true hippie. But I was there in the crossover between hippie and punk. And I started dressing as a hippie because that's what everyone, you know, I went to see Hawkwind and they were all hippies. And then when punk happened in London, I was in London. And I was very conscious that you kind of had to be in one camp or the other. And I didn't want to do that. So even back in the day, I would cross over my clothing so that I was mixing punk leather jackets with hippie harem pants and things like that. So I started wearing the same sorts of weird mashing up of styles when I was 18, 19. And that's what I've always done because I travel a lot. Of course, I love fabrics and I'm very respectful of cultures. So I wear clothes from other cultures as well.
You're a bowerbird, really.
Yes, I'm a bowerbird. Yeah, yeah. I'm a bowerbird.
But part of what your aesthetic is and you use the hashtag, my wrinkles are my stripes.
Yes.
You've earned it, you say, and that what you do is about being true to yourself.
Absolutely.
True to your style.
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly right, Cassie. I think that that's one of the reasons that my Instagram has become so popular, because I think it's very clear. I hope it's very clear that I literally don't plan anything for Instagram. I have no clue what I'm going to post tomorrow morning.
It's like a diary.
Yes, it is. It's when it started to go off.
I hope it's not a picture of you just pointing to me and my head to toe black.
Well, you never know. But I mean, the point is that, you know, like when I was first in America, a lot of the old advanced style ladies would say to me, how have you got so many followers? And I said, I don't know. And I'd say, look, I truly don't even know what I'm going to post tomorrow morning. So I'll probably post a picture hopefully today from the ABC tomorrow morning, but I live my life and I take pictures. Sometimes I'll have a backlog of pictures. If something's happened in my life which is pertinent to a picture from back in the day, I'll bring that up and I'll write something. And my followers now know how to read between the lines. Like often I'll put up a picture which is a statement visually and just write one or two words like mood. And if I've got a finger sticking up and I'm writing mood, they know that I'm in a bad, you know, something's happened.
I should let the listeners know that you're flipping the bird.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But yeah, so it's very, very organic, and that's the way I've lived my life.
All right, well, everyone has to go and check out your Instagram. We'll put some links and some of the highlights. There aren't very many lowlights on our program page. Just in one little phrase, what's next? What's the next buzz?
The next thing that's happening is that I've been offered a book deal with Unbound Publishers in London. It's a crowdfunding situation. I'd literally signed off on it 2 days ago, so I've just announced it. There's a little video. If you want to go to the website, so for the next 6 months, I'm working on a book.
Wow, did you
ever think? As well as travelling.
Ever think that this would be a career taking off for you at this time? Fantastic. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you very much for having me, Cassie.
Thank you. Oh, wow. That's Sarah Mai. Now, we'll put all those bits of information on the Life Matters homepage and also on the Facebook page. Well, that's it for Life Matters. I'm Cassie McCullough. I'm going to be bringing you this program 2 days a week, Thursday and Friday morning, if you're listening in the daylight, and Friday morning and Saturday morning if you're listening in the wee hours. The rest of the week, Ellen Fanning will be with you. She's back on Monday. Thanks very much for your company and have a fantastic weekend.